Yes, good. All right, Boca Tov, we're coming to the end of this semester, I'm going to call it. I hope it's the way I describe it. And thank God we've learned every month since August, September. And I felt we had to do one session on Hanukkah. I mean, it deserves our attention, there's no question about that. As with Megillat Esther, which I've been teaching on Wednesday mornings, I always take a little bit of a contrary view, contrary look at the holiday. And I already gave a bit of this shiur over on last Wednesday, but I want to develop it a little bit more. Sorry?
What do you mean a contrary?
Contrary. I'm sorry, not a country view. Contrary.
It's your accent.
It's my wife went once to a place where they would do, like a JCC, and they were offering courses. So she said she wanted to do pottery. So the woman said poetry. She said no, pottery. Pottery. Until she got the expression right to say it means pottery. You know, it's a different. It's a language which is the same, which divides the two nations quite happily.
I have to share something.
Yes, sure.
When I first came to Cherry Hill and I saw these big signs on trees, leaf collection on such and such a day, and I thought, oh, that's so cute! They're collecting leaves and then making like. David was laughing so hard.
That's funny.
They're collecting all these terrible.
It's all perception, you know. Rain Man when he says don't walk, and he's never, you know, he's autistic, so he's in the middle of the road, and he stops in the middle of the road, you know, and it's a question of perception. That was a very powerful scene, you know. It really shows how we are conditioned by our surroundings. All right, so before we just get to this page that I've given you, I just again want to. Look at the general view of Hanukkah, and Hanukkah is one of those holidays where I think the rabbis are very uncomfortable. And why I say that is because there's clearly two elements in the holiday, the element of the miracle of the oil, and then the element of the war. And when you read about the war, firstly you find there's nothing in the Jewish Bible, meaning the Tanakh, on Hanukkah, right? Hanukkah does not feature in the Tanakh. In fact, it was missed out. There were a number of what they call Sfarim Chitzoniyim, Apocrypha, or whatever it had the Greek name. And one of the books, or in fact there are two books, the Book of the Maccabees. So one wonders that those books, which presumably were written in authentic style, etc., you know, they're not included in the canon, not included in the Bible. It kind of begs the question why. And there's an even bigger question, which I may have spoken about, I remember, which is Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Judah the Prince, the author of the Mishnah, does not have Mishnah Hanukkah. There's Mishnah Sukkah, there's Mishnah Shoshana, there's Mishnah, you know, Mishnah everything, Mishnah Shabbat, Mishnah Purim, Megillah, right? But no Mishnah Hanukkah. And when you try and find Hanukkah in the Mishnah, it's not there. It's there in such a roundabout way. There's a Mishnah at the end of Masechet Ta'anit, talks about when Rosh Chodesh and the whole thing of Hanukkah, how you do the combine, I think Rosh Chodesh and Hanukkah or something like that. Whatever it is, it's certainly not there. There's one reference in Baba Kama, what happens if a camel is walking along with a big stack of hay on its back and somebody's did his menorah outside his store and it catches fire, who's responsible for the fire? You know, you're allowed to do the mitzvah, and in Israel they always put it outside in that glass case, what I call the fish tank, and they put it, who was that in the front, you know, the front porch or whatever. So there's even a Mishnah about it. But that's not a Mishnah on Hanukkah, that's a Mishnah in Baba Kama dealing with damages. So Hanukkah was always on the edge. When the rabbis talked about it in Gemara Shabbat, they almost on purpose don't talk about the war. And I just want to share this thought with you because Rav Soloveitchik says it so beautifully. He says, when you look at the Al HaNisim, which we think about it in the Amidah, it's all about the war, right? When we talk about Bimei Matityo, and we talk about the Malchut Yavan, the evil Greeks stood against the Jewish people, Lashkicham, Torotech, etc., Ravted, Rivan, there's all reference to the war, right? There's only one thing that's missing. It says the evil ones were in the hand, the many and the few, the impure in the hands of the pure, the evil in the hands of the tzaddikim, the zaydim, the presumptuous ones in the hands of those who study Torah. There's only one element missing here, the Greeks given over to the hands of the Jews. It doesn't say that, right? What's the implication, says Rav Soloveitcher? He says, you know what happened? Because the reality was the war part of it was not Greek against Jew as much as it was Jew against Jew. The Mityavnim, the Hellenists, were Jewish. So what was going on at Hanukkah time was not such a happy situation historically, because it was essentially a civil war, right? And we're always trained to think that it was an army coming from the outside and this band of guerrilla warfare experts, the Maccabees and whatever, but it was much more against Jew, meaning the Hellenists had supported the whole takeover of Greek culture, etc. And along comes these pesky, you know, sort of Orthodox Jews who come along and say, well, we're rejecting all of that and we want to re-establish our values, etc., including opening up the temple and all the stuff that we learn about. But the main focus is Jew against Jew. And that, says Rab Soloveitcher, is the reason why it's not mentioned in the Alei Nisim, that the Greeks into the hands of the Jews as one of the elements of Hanukkah is not really true, because it was much more about Jews in the hands of Jews. And that's a frightening statement. And he says, not even, and in fact, the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writes about Judah the Prince. Interesting thing. He says, why is it not in the Mishnah? He says, because Judah the Prince came from David HaMelech. He knew his line goes right back to King David. He was in the line of kings. And along comes Hanukkah, and who became king of the country, the kings of the country after the Hanukkah story? The Hasmoneans. What were the Hasmoneans? They were Kohanim. Were Kohanim allowed to be kings? No. Right? Kings had to come from the tribe of Yehuda. Right? So the problem was that because the Hasmoneans, after the story of Hanukkah, literally usurped the throne, right? Then you've got an issue in terms of the history of Hanukkah, that although it's a phenomenal event, but are we really comfortable about the outcome of the event? And read about it, read about the events of the Second Temple, read Josephus, it's not such a happy period, and of course eventually everything goes very, very bad with all the different names of the leaders and fighting between the leaders before the Romans arrive, right? And all of that stuff. So Hanukkah is not... The war side of Hanukkah is not the most comfortable area which we sort of dwell upon.
What did you say the Hashmonim were, the tribe of?
Tribe, they were Kohanim. They were Kohanim. Matityo ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol.
And they usurped
the monarchy. They really took it over. And there's a whole Ramban at the beginning of Parshat Balotcha. They took the whole thing up there about Aaron became very upset with the not having the mitzvah of menorah. So God comforted him, it says, by giving him, saying, in the future, your descendants will light the menorah. But the problem with that is that they also took over the kingship. So they did very well lighting the menorah, rekindling the menorah, but at the same time, they became kings, which they weren't supposed to be. So there's a lot of issues in the Second Temple period, and it's not so straightforward. So what I'm suggesting is that in the element of the holiday, so much more focus has been on the oil and the lighting of the menorah than on the actual victory of war. And of course that sort of fits in very nicely. It's what we're going to talk about, the famous, what I call the most famous question of Hanukkah that's ever been asked. And one of the answers to the question is about the war. So we'll come to that in a few minutes. So I just wanted to preface what we're going to say about Hanukkah by saying that what eventually happened to the holiday is, as much as it did not become this great celebration of a victory of war, which in fact, if you think about it, comparing to Purim, it was, I would say, you know, I don't know what number to put on it, how much more intense the victory of Hanukkah was than the victory of Purim in terms of what happened, right? Because not only did the war officially, the temple was open, what was it, 165 BCE, the war carried on for another 25 years. And you read the book of Maccabees, and you read about Shimon Maccabee and all these other brothers of Yehuda Maccabee, you know, they were around for a long time, continuing to sort of push out the Hellenists from Israel, essentially, or you know, bring it back to Judaism, and all that stuff didn't happen overnight. So in terms of a war campaign, this was much bigger. And yet, when it comes to Hanukkah, we're very uncomfortable. You know, what do? We do lakkas, we do oily things, right? We don't sit down. Even to have a suda, there's a whole discussion in the halacha whether we sit and have a special meal in honor of Hanukkah. which we don't usually do. You know, I mean, in yeshiva we always did it, but it was always prefaced with the Rosh Yeshiva would always make us understand that the meal of Hanukkah that we're having has to be with Divrei Torah about Hanukkah, because the focus is not on the meal, but it's on the Torah. Right? So therefore, again, there was always this discomfort with the holiday. And I guess that's why the holiday got bound up maybe with more of the secular stuff. I mean, in the modern state of Israel, it does come back to the idea of winning wars. And of course, you know, even in the secular Israeli mindset, there is a very big place for Hanukkah. And it is, as I've mentioned, I think I've mentioned here as well, that when I was in the army in 85, I did my basic training in Israel. We had to do this, what's called Tekes Hashpa'ah, the swearing-in ceremony, which some of you may have been to, and it's an unbelievable event. And for the army becomes a real army for me at that moment, because you actually do army things like marching. Because the Israeli army is too busy fighting to do anything like marching and parading and saluting and all this sort of stuff. You know, you got to get on with learning how to sort of shoot guns and get on with it. And the officers, you know, it was on Hanukkah that we had this ceremony, so we had to march. So what did we march to? We marched to Mars Tour. What else are you going to march to? Right? So imagine, you know, that this big band, I could just say it in America, you know, this 100-piece band that play Mars Tour as the army marches, you know, does these march paths. And it's not a Hebrew tune. I mean, we did also other Hanukkah too. It was a lot of fun. I wish I would have recorded it, because it really was an experience and unforgettable. But that's the Jewish army. So Hanukkah has re-adopted that war element to it. No question about that. But even there, you'll see that in the yeshivot, the focus of Hanukkah is much more about the miracles and the idea of Torah being the light of the Jewish people, etc. All the symbolism of Hanukkah is clearly more in that direction and more focused, certainly from a religious perspective, than towards the war and the victory, etc. As I said, a very uncomfortable subject. And clearly something which is reflected. When you look for it, there are nuances, even in what we have, the tefillot, etc., saying, you know, this wasn't such a great event in Jewish history from that perspective. The miracle, yes. The war, not so much. And what I want to show you here, is on the page I gave you, is the famous, famous question of the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Joseph Cairo, a man who lived about 500 years ago in Tzfat. When you go to Tzfat, it's one of the shuls that you have to go and see. There are like two or three shuls, the Menorat Amor, the Shmuel Abuav, and Yosef Cairo, and there's another shul, I've forgotten that. These are phenomenal synagogues. I mean, they've been around for literally 500-600 years. And the shul of the Beit Yosef is really one of the most magnificent shuls, beautiful. And he lived in around the year 1550, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. And before he authored the Shulchan Aruch, he authored something called the Beit Yosef, the actual commentary, which was on the original halakhic document known as the Torah. This is a man steeped in halakhic tradition. Was Sephardi, right? And unapologetically Sephardi. It's very interesting. And in his commentary on Hanukkah, right at the beginning, he brings his famous question. And as I said, this is a question which is universal and is known around the world, and I'm going to argue has carried Jews, really. The festival of Hanukkah has been lit up by this question. It becomes our support system for Hanukkah, for the celebration of Hanukkah, certainly from the point of view of rabbinic interpretation. So listen to this. Ikkel HaMeidos, first paragraph on the page. I brought the original because I thought it was revealing how he writes it. He says, we have to make that means to look into this. He says, Lama, Kavu Shmoni Yamim. Why are there 8 days Hanukkah? Right? Sort of question that we don't usually ask because, you know, we accept it. But he says, why? Dikivan de Shemen Shabapach Hayabo Kadei Ladlik Lailechad. We know that the oil was enough for one night. Nimsa Shalo Nasa Nes Elabashiva Leilot. So 1 day oil was normal. 7 days after that, till they got the new oil, was miraculous. The celebration of Hanukkah is a celebration of miracles, so have a 7-day holiday, period. Why do we need the 8th day? Why have the extra day of Hanukkah? Right? And that's the question. And of course, you can always argue.
Is he including the first day in those 7 days?
Yeah, he's, well, again,
he's saying
that's
a miracle,
but then the first day's not a miracle.
First day's not a miracle. What he's obviously going to have to try and do is to find what was the miracle on the first day. Right? And that's what he's going to sort of work on. And it's very famous. And I'll just show you how he works so hard to do this. And every step of the way becomes literally a source for people have written books upon books upon books. And we're talking about Jews, great rabbinic minds right around the world. Right? Beit Yosef, we're talking about Eretz Yisrael, Tzfat. We're going to go to Europe. We're going to go into... Or in fact, the question was already raised before the Beit Yosef, 200 years earlier, by the Meiri. Meiri was from Germany, 13th century. We're going to go from there, we're going to go to Hungary, we're going to go to Poland, we're going to go now to Eretz Israel, because so much of the literature now is coming out of Israel, talking again from new about the same question. So what's so beautiful is that this question, although it's so specific, is really so generic. It carries the Jewish people literally around the world, from place to place. It's gone with us. It's like in our bag. In our bag, we've got our menorah, we've got our lights, we've got our oil, we've got our wicks, and we've got this question of the Beit Yosef. And this is the way I see it. I see it as this fantastic addition and essential support system for what Hanukkah should be all about, what Hanukkah really means. So I'm putting it in those terms because you'll see we're going to go on this trip, and it's a little trip literally through the history of Jewish communities, starting with the Beit Yosef and going from there. So listen to this. Second line, just give the famous answer, the Eish Lomar, Shechilku Shemesh Avapach L'Shmona Chalokim. First answer, he says, they divided the oil into 8 parts. Right? So obviously that means on day one, only 1/8 of the oil was used. So it's a miracle on day one. Right? Because only 1/8 of the oil was there, but the oil burned the whole day. And he says, B'chol Lailo Yinot Menorah Chelik Echon. So the menorah only had 1/8 of the amount that it needed every single night. Vayad dolek ad haboker, and it lit to the morning. V'nimtza shebechol halilot naaseh nes, a miracle every single night.
How can it be a nes if there was shem in there for every night?
Sorry?
How can it be a nes if there was shem
there? But wasn't there wasn't the full amount? It was only a little bit. It was only a little bit. But it gets even more interesting.
But the challenge I would have on it is,
yeah,
how would you know to divide it into 8 nights?
Yeah.
You know, like, if right, you're 9 oil for one night, and you're lighting your menorah,
how did you know it was going to last?
Yeah. How did you divide it into 12?
Yeah. Why not keep a bit back? I mean, the number is challenging. How would you know to do that? It's even more basic than that, because we understand that, you know, and again, I spoke about this a bit on the last session that I gave on this, is that there is a concept not relying on miracles. And all of a sudden, they're dividing into 8 parts, right? So you've got 1/8. Instead of 8 ounces, you've got 1 ounce of oil, and you're relying on the fact that this is going to burn the whole night. So is that relying on a miracle? Right? And we're not supposed to. If I go out to the street and say, God, send me money from heaven, with all due respect, you know, it's not going to happen. So
where would the concept even have come from?
Well, maybe
why would they come in, find oil, and say, let's divide it so we can have an 8-day holiday?
Because, yeah. Wait, because they probably thought that in 8 days...
they'll get the new oil.
Shipment will come in.
Yeah.
But they didn't expect it to last. You know, they probably did want it.
But
they
said,
let's look for, spend the next 24 hours.
Yeah.
They figured, look, we're going to be without oil for about 1 week. Maybe we should divvy it up and see what happens.
And see how much. And 8 days became, I would say, a kind of almost a random number, but it became the realistic number of the amount of time it would take to get the regular oil was going to be 8 days. But it could have been 10 days. I mean, that's one of the questions. And look at the second paragraph over here, because this, again, as I said, Meir has even raised this question before the Beit Yosef on this particular point. He says, Yesh mi shepire she'av he megishu b'miyut ha-shemen chilku l'shmon ha-leilo k'shir halicha v'chazara. So he explains that the reason why it was 8 days, because that will be the time to go and come back to bring the oil back. So that was the 8 days. But he says, nearly. The Meiri, 13th century German commentary, says, no, this doesn't seem right. She'im kein, heichayu sobcha l'anes. B'layla Rishonai says that means that the first night they only put in that little amount, and it's already relying on a miracle.
Why is it? Because if you light a small amount and it burns for an hour the first night, So burn for an hour. Then you have an hour for the next night, an hour for the next night.
But are you allowed...
Where is it said that you need to burn? Is it
to be burning constantly.
Constantly, the whole night.
It has to be... Yeah. So, in order for what?
For to be Yotza the Mitzvah. There's the Mitzvah is very, very... You know,
you light the menorah.
How it's spelled out.
And it...
Mer tamid.
And it's was constantly burning.
Got to be a constant
burning.
Correct.
They were trying
correct.
To rekindle it.
They were trying to... So,
right. And the whole thing of only doing a little bit. So, of course, you know, along come the Hasidic gentlemen and talk about this idea. Well, you know what? At the end of the day, it's all about sort of making that leap. You know, Nachshon ben Aminadab. Nachshon ben Aminadab, what did he do? He saw the sea was not splitting. Jews on one side, the Egyptians on the other side. There's the sea. So what did he do? He jumped in. And he went up to his neck. And as soon as he got up to the point where he was almost drowning, whoosh, then the sea split. So the idea is that, no, we jump in. We don't wait for, maybe, even not waiting for God. Of course, you get into sort of the whole 1948 mindset here. Because what happened in 1948? We jumped in, made a state of Israel, and what will be. And of course, you know, religiously inspiring, I still wonder at people who don't say halal on Yom HaShmud. It just amazes me. That we lived through such an event, and they're not... I mean, how can you not see the hand of God in all of that? But of course, what it did take is a tremendous leap of faith when Ben-Gurion announced the State of Israel, that famous film. And it doesn't show you on the film, but afterwards, when they said Shechionu, he put a kippah, right? And the people sitting around, it was the most amazing moment in Jewish history in the modern age. And the fact is that it took that leap of faith. So putting that little bit of oil was the leap of faith. All right, so you get into that kind of literature, which is fine. And, of course, that's what we've always done. We've always sort of maybe done something in the hope, in the faith that, you know, it will turn out for the best. And as I make notes on this, I said this whole question of bitachon, relying on Hashem, hishtadlut, making the effort, right? Do we do this? And you saw yesterday with Yaakov Avinu, you know, Esav is coming to fight him. So what does Yaakov do? Divides up the camp and makes sure there's one group and another group, and he makes all the preparation. And he's a man of faith, he's a man of trust, but he's also got to do his own effort. You know, you can rely on God to a certain point, but you've got to go out there and do your stuff. So the reality is that this is, again, sort of part of the discussion on answer number one. And believe me, I've got a book at home that's actually probably with me. I think there's at least devoted 30 pages of discussion about this whole thing of dividing the oil into eight. So that's answer number one. Answer number two and three are very similar. Third line, but Odi Shlomar, he says, I want to suggest another answer. Shalacha shenot nushemim b'neirot ha-menorah k'shi'ur nishah ha-pach malei k'vatchila. What happened was they filled the menorah and it filled up on the first night as it was meant to do. But what happened was that the oil was not in the oil in the menorah wasn't the miracle. The oil was in the jar. The jar remained full. It's like one of those things you buy for your kids, you know, when it doesn't sort of you pour it out and it stays full, you know, that kind of thing. But this was the real deal. And he says even on the first night after they'd emptied the jar of the oil, it remained filled, fine. Or he says you can say the other way: Inami shebeleil rishon not the kol Hashem b'neiron. They put all the oil into the holders of the menorah on the first night. V'dolku kol ha-laila, they burnt for the whole night. V'boker matzo ha-neiron, they came back in the morning, and it wasn't that the jar of oil was filled, but the containers of the menorah were still filled to the brim with oil. Melei ha-shemin, chem b'chol laila v'laila. So whichever way you learn, either it was the jar, or it was the holders of the oil, whichever way you look at it, there was a sense that the oil stayed exactly where it was at the beginning and did not diminish. Okay, so those again are two suggestions. And there's again even big discussion about this. I've just brought here Pri Chadash, and who is again more, I suppose, about 17th century, also from Poland. They really, every step of what was suggested by Beit Yosef was analyzed, dissected. Some agreed with it, some didn't like the concept, because again, if oil becomes filled up and has not been put in by you, then it's not oil that we have made, but it's oil, it's called Shemen Nes. The actual oil is called miracle oil. And the question is miracle oil allowed to be used as oil for burning the menorah? If I'm, you know, I go to buy my oil at ShopRite and I get oil, it's not miracle oil. Okay, a miracle that I suppose they're selling it, but a miracle is not the actual oil. And I put it in and I use it every night, whatever. But here, the sort of oil that is being used, certainly according to the way Beit Yosef describes it, takes the oil out of being natural oil into miracle oil. Right? And again, there was enormous literature about the fact, could they have used this oil in any sense if it's not natural oil? Because when the Torah talks about Shemen Zayit Zach, pure olive oil, that's olive oil that we have taken the olives and we've smushed them and we've pressed them and we've done all we have to do. We've produced it, not that God produces the oil for us. So I can't begin to tell you, the literature here is off the charts.
Sorry? That should even be better.
It should be better, but it's missing the basic definition of what is required to be used. What is required to be used is the oil that we produce. We can get very inspired by the miracle and the oil, but bottom line, halakha, are we allowed to use it? So I guess, you know, you can argue, well, what can be better than that oil? I mean, that's one of the suggestions, and there's a lot to say, yeah.
Does anyone give the simple explanation that you put the oil in, and the rate at which the oil was used up was just slower?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you don't need to have a miraculous container that fills up, you know,
automatically.
You don't need it to be completely full.
Yeah.
It just went down at a slower rate than it ordinarily.
Correct, and that is...
And therefore, the first one is miraculous, and all of them
as all the days, and that's...
Miracle was occurring each day.
Correct, and that's the... It took a Lithuanian to say it, thank God. Because this is, at the moment, as I said, we're journeying around Poland. So in Poland, I mean,
Pri Chadash
was one of the really big commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. I don't know what the man's name was. You'd have to sort of Google it to find out. I mean, it's certainly available to find out the information, the Pri Chadash. But very, very major work. Sorry?
Related to the Bai Chadash?
No, Bai Chadash, the Bach is earlier. Bai Chadash, that's your family, yeah.
I have the whole tree.
Circus. Bai Chadash's family name is Circus.
The whole tree showing my grandfather directly.
Direct from the Bai Chadash, the Bach. Yeah, that's very...
That's
Yichus. That's an interesting thing. The Pri Chadash, I don't know. It's certainly on, when you buy the Shulchan Aruch, I mean, I may have a copy of it here, it's one of the commentaries on the page. So he's pretty big. And... all of this, again, is discussion within discussion. And the one rabbi I thought was very smart about the dividing the oil into eight parts. He said, look, at the end of the day, you don't necessarily, you know, this is surely relying on a miracle. So he says, no. He says, what they did, in contrast to what Rabbi Cairo said, he said they divided the oil into eight parts, but they also made the wicks into eighths. Instead of regular wicks, they had eighths. So what that meant is that the oil and the wicks were, again, in ratio of burning for exactly one day. But because they had diminished the size of the oil and the size of the wicks, right, it's not now such a difficult suggestion of what they did, because they weren't taking oil and using less oil. They were doing oil proportionately less by having thinner wicks, right, if that makes sense. So what would happen is that you'd have an eighth of an oil with an eighth of a wick every single day, and as a consequence, the oil would continue burning as a regular oil, maybe with a much thinner light, for those 8 days. And therefore, even on the first day, because of the fact that you had the small amount of oil and the thinner wick, you weren't necessarily sort of relying the oil completely. It should be miraculous, because by thinning down the wick, the miracle element was reduced. Because you had a thinner wick, you had less oil, but according to nature, that should burn the same amount of time.
And there's no miracle.
And then almost to the point, there's no miracle, almost to the point. So, as I said, whichever way you turn, you
always get... It still wouldn't burn the whole night.
Sorry?
Even if you shorten the wick, it still wouldn't burn the whole night.
Right, and the fact that maybe the miracle of it burning the whole night is still...
10% charge left, which should last only an hour.
Yeah.
You turn on low power mode.
Yeah.
And it lasts 8 hours.
Correct.
Then it's not a miracle. You've just decided to use less energy.
Yes.
You're having a dimmer...
Yeah.
That explanation
tells
us why...
Because you've been alluding to this, Kev, because you've alluded to this, I've just got to show on the other side, page two. And this is Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, I mentioned in my shir, because we talk about these names. Soloveitchik, this is the Rav's grandfather, right? And he died in 1918. So for those who had a connection to Rav Soloveitchik, you had that direct link to Reb Chaim Soloveitcher. Reb Chaim was really one of the real changes in Lithuania of the whole yeshiva system. Everything about him. My zechut in my yeshiva, I had my Rosh Yeshiva, Blev Gurevich, who when I went to the yeshiva, he was already in his 70s. As a young, so this is 1970, so he was born around 1906 or whatever. So Reb Chaim Soloveitcher died in 1918. So Reb Leib Gurevich, when he was 10 years old, had been sent by his family to Brisk, to the town of Brest-Litovsk, which is the town, and he'd studied as a young man, and he'd been in the shir of Reb Chaim Soloveitcher, which really blows my mind, right? Because again, we talk about some of these figures as being as once somebody put it to me, you know, that the historical time frames are so complicated that you have to talk about Rashi and the Chofetz Chaim, were they in the same generation? And the answer is no, of course not. 1,000 years apart. And with Chaim Soloveitcher, we also think of him as being sort of hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And yet you meet people, or I've met people who, you know, knew him personally. So it's one of those incredible things that, you know, we have this kind of handover, this connection, and that generation from pre-war definitely dying out very, very quickly. There's not many of them left. But it's always interesting to hear from them as to who they were, had they interacted with, and to find out what their background is. And even in America today, there's really not many people around. Another Rav in London was very close to the Chofetz Chaim, and actually got a bracha from him before he left Radin. And he actually came to England as a young man. He got a bracha from the Chofetz Chaim. He always told us about this. And it's somebody that I sat and learnt with. We used to have a shiur with him every Friday night. So it's really, you know, that interaction, that handing over of the baton, you know, from generation to generation, is really one of the great things of Jewish life. And Reb Chaim said it simply, and I wrote it in English: the miracle is in the quality, not the amount of the oil. Surely the oil cannot be miracle oil, right? It can't be miracle oil. It's got to be regular oil. So he says, no, what happened was the miracle was in the quality of the oil. Instead of burning the whole thing in one shot or in one night, the oil took on. I explained it, somebody explained it to me, and I think it works when you talk about gas being regular as opposed to super. What's super gas, right? And you go and fill up. It's when you have that extra whatever they put into it, not sure what it is, and they charge you more money for it. And what happened was that the oil became supercharged. All right, so instead of the oil maybe burning the whole amount in one night, it's so supercharged that only a small amount managed to be the quality of the oil became so strong that small amount burned the equivalent of a regular vial of oil, only a small amount burned, and it was the miracle was in the quality of the oil, not in the quantity. And of course, Reb Chaim makes a whole thing about this, and in fact, Reb Zevin, one of the great writers, Moedim Balacha, brings this whole discussion from Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and he says Reb Chaim was very excited about this because Jews have never been famous for our numbers, right? As Chief Rabbi Sachs always sort of mentions to us, he's very often, where he got this from I don't know, but he said that in China, the census in China varies by 15 million. He says if we, the Jewish people, were in China, we wouldn't even feature on the census because we're the mistake. 15 million, one way or the other, right? So we don't even feature in China as a group. So he said, you know, we're a small number. I was horrified. I mean, I'm very excited to dedicate this shiur to Boris Johnson, I have to say, with all due respect. But I was absolutely devastated. What was devastated? On Friday, after this gentleman, Corbyn, whose name I should not mention, was not really backtracking so much at that point.
You saw the chassid next to him?
And there was
in
a
the
from
Times?
Guy. Yes, yeah, yeah.
What
yeah.
was that?
Yeah, well, you're allowed. There's a guy standing. I thought just to make the point from the Green Party. Go, figure.
Shaven?
Yeah, with the guy with the kippah. Yeah.
Out. There are phrases. And what?
Yeah, I think it was a bit making up more of an image.
With Trump,
like three
yeah.
people.
But what happened was, believe it or not, one of the supporters of Corbyn, who was thrown out of the party, was very, very well reported. Unfortunately, still is well reported. He said, well, I blame the Jewish vote. The Jewish vote in England, what is he talking about? 200,000 people out of 60 million. And he was coming on and saying, well, the Jewish vote obviously made a big difference. I mean, that unfortunately is why, and so many people are saying it, and it's a bracha in a way, that they're recognizing that because they were so unapologetic about the anti-Semitism, it's one of the reasons they lost the election, the Labour Party.
And that's Ishayahu's nevuah coming true.
And it's all happening. Harold Wilson, who was the famous head of the... If you're watching The Crown, he's very, very good in the third series. And they thought he was a Russian spy. Wilson was so pro-Israel. In his day, not only his son went to live on kibbutz, it's a very famous story. Not only that, but he was responsible for bringing out one of the famous Chabad rabbis from Russia. He was instrumental in bringing him out in 1962 from Siberia. The man had been in Siberia for 20 years. And Wilson was so connected to Israel, he really will be turning in his grave over what's happened in the Labour Party. It's no question in my mind. So again, you know, we're only hoping for the best. Johnson is very, very interesting character. Watch him, because you can compare him to what we have in this country, which is madness, you know, sort of never-ending from what I can see, except when it comes to the Jewish community. All of a sudden, in the middle of it all, you get a fantastic presidential order about anti-Semitism on campus. Phenomenal thing. It's just unbelievable. And whatever you say about it, I know on campus what goes on.
The Times reported that Jews are divided about this.
Well, I'm sorry. I was on Columbia campus for 15 years. If they can now do something about that pressure, the kids are really under pressure. And Nebuch, last week, one of the girls was killed. There wasn't through the Palestinian justice group or whatever, but the Jewish community is a bit spooked over that.
From Barnum.
And it's really, really frightening.
I live on that block.
Yeah, on Morningside. So it's pretty devastating. And again, it's just so interesting. Back to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, sometimes we've got to appreciate, as much as we don't have the quantity, there's no question, there's not a lot of us in the world, but the quality, thank God, shines through every so often, and that's something to be excited about. Yeah.
Well, going back to what Chaim Soloveitchik said, when you read it, I mean, at the risk of, I don't know how this is going to sound, it's really all just conjecture.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to say, well, it must have been better quality, it must have been, you know, looking for answers, looking in hindsight,
correct,
really no...
You may say they divided it as this way, it's either fact or not.
Everything
fact.
Here is all
guessing. There's no guessing. Way.
Yeah.
These are we're looking for
opinions.
Answers.
Yeah.
Of course.
This is, I mean, Joyce, you've hit the nail on the head. What the rabbis like spending all day doing, and this is what you spend most of your life in yeshiva doing, is to spend your life with conjecture.
Right.
What if, right, in Hebrew, in Aramaic, lu yitzuya means what if it would be the following,
right,
and what if this, and what if that. And the Gemara is full of that. But the point is that becomes the sort of the swell of Jewish learning is within that area of what ifs. Because that increases, Yagdil Torah, that increases and focuses you on different situations and distinctions and sometimes very hairline distinctions between A and B and C. And we know that's what Talmud's all about. So it is interesting, and a lot of this is very speculative. But I just love the fact that they would spend so much energy and so much focus on this. And this is what, again, Hanukkah became. For people who couldn't celebrate and were uncomfortable with the other element of Hanukkah, the more military side of it, here it becomes so inspiring. This generates literally thousands and thousands of pages of discussion and in yeshivot and around the world. And again, we've moved, right, we've gone from Tzvat, we're now in Lithuania, we've moved around the world. This is the greatness of Torah. And many people argue that as much as it is speculation, of course it is, but it makes you think, it makes you revisit, it makes you reanalyze.
And I think that ties back to what you said before, that you know, people who are more secular, who can take some comfort in the military victory.
Correct.
I think when you look at Israel now, and you look at the people who are not observant, Hanukkah is such an easy holiday.
It
because
is.
You can either find the religious aspect, or you can deal with the part of it that's just
correct.
Cultural and you know, and
latkes.
Correct.
And eat latkes.
And sufganiyot.
But people who are more secular can find something to identify with, and people who are more religious see the Torah view of it. And
correct.
But I have a problem with correct. The Torah view of it, because why are they focusing on the minutiae of the holiday, of lighting? Really, who cares about the oil when you think about it, when what happened was so significant.
Yeah, and it
it's
is straight.
Chinam between Jew versus Jew.
Correct. And that's
so much more important.
And
you're, to focus
and
on.
That's that was my introduction, and that's
right.
that what is
it's not
really.
A nice thing to deal with.
Yeah, because we don't, we almost, and this is the point, we maybe don't want to face the reality of what Hanukkah story was about. Very much like Purim. We don't do the reality of Purim, which is the question I'm going to deal with next semester in that shiur, which is Esther at the end of the story stays with Ahasuerus, Not only that, but they have a child together. You know, go work that one out. And here's a nice Jewish girl that all the kids dress up as Esther.
Yeah.
And she's not only is she living with the guy, but she then has a child. Turns out to be an interesting story in the end. But go figure. So
here you do have a theme that's central for all time, which is sort of the fight against the culture of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's profound. And that, of course, you know, everybody can look at this through history. And
correct.
Look at, you know, yeah, the relevance of the Hanukkah story, even if it played out in unpleasant ways at that time, it's a struggle for all time.
Correct. And that in really itself is... Yeah.
This struggle, this civil war thing, is
yeah,
not a one-time thing. In Yeshayahu's days, they talked about part of the tribes ganging up with another kingdom.
Correct.
Against their few Jewish people in Yerushalayim.
Correct.
It's not news.
I tell you,
it's today with the Bechirot in Israel.
At the Bechirot, election number 3.
A lot of sinat.
I know, it's terrible.
In the worst way.
It's so interesting. Last week, Just to elaborate on that point, I finished my syllabus at college. I finished Sefer Melachim Bet and Sefer Yeshua.
Right.
And both ends of those books are so depressing.
No.
Why is it depressing? Because Sefer Melachim Bet ends with destruction of the temple and Gedaliah. Mm-hmm. What is Gedaliah? Gedaliah is a Jew who's killed by other Jews.
Right.
I mean, it's a terrible thing. And then you've got the end of Sefer Yeshua, which is not well known, is that the 2.5 tribes go back across the Jordan to Eretz Gilad, and the rest of the Jews say, "Well, they're going home. They've left. They leave a mizbeah, some token monument to the Jewish people." And the rest of the Jews immediately say, "Tzava, we're going to fight a war with the 2.5 tribes because they think they're breaking away from Jewish life by going over the Jordan and starting to live like Canaanites." And before you look around, the end of Book of Joshua already got the potential for civil war. Scariest thing, and I remember hearing Chaim Herzog, when he was president, President Herzog, say, this was 30 years ago, we'll deal with the Arabs, we'll have peace one day, whenever it will be. And then we've got to start working on having peace amongst ourselves. And that's the real challenge.
Ourselves and, then with the
and I think it may come the other way around. You may be right. I'd like to think it will be that way around. I've got one or two more points to make. Because, what you see is that what is so beautiful about this question is that it mushrooms into all the, what I call the more philosophical elements. The Pri Chadash himself, or was it the Tanna? The Pri Chadash also talks about this one day in memory of the war. Right, so that again is a completely separate answer. 7 days of miracle for the oil. Why we have the extra day? Because they won the war. So he's prepared Pri-Chadash in 17th century Poland to bring in the element of war as a reason why we have the extra day. But certainly Beit Yosef wasn't prepared to say that. And you'll see most of the other commentaries in Chaim Soloveitchik did not say that. So I think he was being very brave. The fact that he wants to conclude the fact that it's to do with the war, and that we're celebrating an extra day because of winning the war, is quite a, let's put it this way, quite a very brave stance of that mainstream rabbi of his particular day. If you turn over on the other side, you've got, and this is the article that I would refer you to, I mean, I hope many of you have this book at home, Lior Kitov, The Book of Our Heritage, in Hebrew, Sefer Toda'ah, and he brings, really, he brings 10 answers to this. He brings more answers than I could bring here. And in the middle there, what I call two philosophical answers. Answer number one is the recognition that what we call nature is really miracle, and what we think is the natural world is all miracle.
Can you repeat this?
Yeah, Eliyahu Kitov, Sefer Toda'ah.
Right.
And he says, first he says, nature and miracle, which we sort of clear in our minds that we make a distinction, he says it's all miracle. And he gives an example, or he makes the famous gematria, I didn't write it on the page, the word Elohim, had a board, I put it on the board, the numerical value, Aleph Lamed Yud Hey Mem, is 86, and Ha Teva, you have to have the Hey, that's a bit of a push, but he says it, Ha Teva, nature, 86. So we think that God and nature are two separate elements. He wants to say that the miracle of Hanukkah was to teach us that the oil, which we thought was such a natural burning, was in itself so miraculous to teach us that nature and miracle are really one and the same. Right? What did Ben-Gurion say about Israel? You know, that something about miracle. I've forgotten the famous quote that he makes about living in Israel. Not every day is a miracle, but something on that line. I always felt there was miraculous.
What's the date of Yom Kippur?
Kitov is very modern, came out of Israel 30 years ago. The Sefer Todah, the Book of Our Heritage in English, a must. It's the most beautiful book. It goes through every month of the year. Many people have it. And it's a book that doesn't get mentioned enough, because not only does he bring all of the customs and the rules and the regulations, but he also brings these beautiful explanations. The final point he says is, again, the idea that the Hanukkah celebration is the idea of doing what you had to do regardless of the consequences. He basically puts it so beautifully. He says, "Lo nityashu mitladlik." You think that they get to the point they'll give up. How can we lie? We've only got a little bit of oil. We need oil for a whole week. We've only got that little amount of oil. But he says, in spirit, they didn't give up. And of course, he's writing, and he writes about sort of this as being, again, very much part of what we are as Jews. I thought of the Warsaw Ghetto, because so much of the history of the story of the Warsaw Ghetto is about people who didn't give up. They knew they weren't going to win, right? And you read the accounts, and you see that there's a film, Uprising, which highlights this very much. They knew they weren't going to win, but they still went ahead and did it, because that is who we are. Sometimes we still are doing our thing, and it's miraculous. And Jewish survival is about that. Who would have thought that we're still here?
But you have to do something.
We got to do something.
The miracle of the human spirit.
And it's the human spirit. And this is what we spoke about. The answer, which I really want to blow your mind, is the second page that you have, what I call page 3. Megillat Antiochus. I mentioned this on Wednesday, and this is amazing. Megillat Antiochus is an old document of the story of Purim, and not quite clear who wrote it. Some say it goes back even into biblical days, but it's not found in the biblical books. It's one of those separate books that you usually find attached to the Siddur, in the Siddur which has that longer Hanukkah service, usually only in Hebrew. You'll find there's always a reference to Megillat Antiochus. The story of Antiochus.
Sorry? The Apocrypha?
No, and this is not in the Apocrypha. It's interesting. They're the Book of Maccabees. Mm-hmm. So that's that version. But here, look at what he says. And I just underlined it in the middle of the section here. Vayabah, the famous thing about the oil, I've underlined the whole section, he talks about the miracle, but he says, Vayabah kishiyur hadlakat yom echad, there was enough oil for one day. That's what we know. Look at the bottom, and it's the note which is literally one star. You'll see there's three lines right at the bottom in the Rashi print. He says, "B'she'iltot the Rabbi Chai Gaon." I'm sorry, it's a very bad print. This. He says there's a book called the She'iltot, 8th century Gaonic literature. So about 1,100 years ago. And he says, "Parshat Vayishla." This is parsha. "Garis haGaon." There, the Gaon, meaning She'iltot Rabbi Chai Gaon, one of the famous Gaonim. He has the version of the whole story, which is changing the story. You never knew this. He says, the story is, V'lo hayabo lahadlik, sorry, the hay is missing, there was not enough oil, afilu liyom echan, even for one day. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, you always thought that they found oil enough for one day. Says Reb Chai Gaon, in his version of the story, there wasn't even enough oil for one day. Means the whole miracle did take place even on day one. Who knew? Right? All of a sudden, the whole story changed. Right, we have to now go and tell Rabbi Galustin. He's got to retell the whole story of Hanukkah. There wasn't even enough oil for one day.
What year is this from?
This is, again, the notes of the She'iltot, but the She'iltot itself is 8th century. Right? So where he gets his tradition from, I don't know. But Megillat Antiochus goes back. Megillat Antiochus, the version that he has is Yom Echad, that it was one day's oil, but the She'iltot refers to the Megillat Antiochus, and he says, Afilu, it didn't even have even one day's oil. When you read that, you say, wow, that everything that I thought was cardinal principle in Jewish life is up for grabs.
So,
it's got to be raised, it's got to be questioned.
So he says the real version is the
lo haya. Lo haya,
so
afilu.
Someone changed the words then.
Yeah.
And that's why there's an 8-day miracle.
And then there's an 8-day miracle. And even on this, there's a book been written, believe it or not. Because some people say, how can you suggest that there wasn't enough oil for one day when everybody says, the Talmud says the one? What's going on here?
Well,
but
this was a
what a way
to fix the whole debate.
It does. One word.
Find the answer that
one word.
Problem, right?
And I so, argue from this how important it is that we know Hebrew. We're living in this fantastic generation where everything is accessible, and thank God we've got books in English coming out of our ears. And that's wonderful. But the bottom line is that you need that nuance. the Hebrew nuance, I joke about it. Students are doing papers for me at the moment. So Microsoft Word, believe it or not, to this very day, in the 21st century, the year 2020 almost, they still cannot do Hebrew properly in Microsoft Word. You have an English document, you put Hebrew in the middle, which they need to do in a paper they write for me, and you present it to me, and the Hebrews come out backwards. Go figure.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a glitch in that program, which has been around for Microsoft Word, for 30 years already? And Microsoft don't even want to take responsibility for it. I don't understand. So I say to the girls, don't use Microsoft Word, but of course that's the most popular program.
The best is the phone. The language on the phone. It's seamless transition.
Ah, okay.
You can type it Hebrew, you can type it English.
Oh, yeah, because you have...
It gets stuck and puts the right margins and the left margins.
Yeah, that's clever.
The question mark and the...
I had a program with Apple for 30 years ago, which was doing Hebrew English, there was a little star in the corner of the desktop, and you just clicked on it and then changed to Hebrew.
The original source of Hanukkah.
Yeah.
When we say in Alanisim, the Kabul or Shmonat Mi Hanukkah, who fixed it?
Much later. Anshek Nesagdola's second temple around the year 450.
So who fixed it? Are there original sources for where Hanukkah comes from and what their rationale was?
Great question. So the answer is that is the double influence that we have, that the war was fixed in terms of making the day of Hanukkah, you know, the remez of Kafhei, Chanu Kafhei, they rested on the 25th, and it was 25th of Kislev was the symbolic day when the war ended in terms of Yerushalayim, when the temple was open. Who fixed it? It says that at that period of time, Matityahu and his family, who were presumably the leading rabbis of their generation, they fixed the holiday. But it wasn't a holiday that was established in the same way, let's say, as Purim, with celebrations and drinking and festivities. They just didn't fix it like that. And in fact, the Gemara says they waited a whole year. The first year of Hanukkah victory, they didn't have a Hanukkah. And some say that if it had been only for the war, they only had one day Hanukkah, and that would have been it. Imagine the whole holiday would only been one day. Then you really had a problem comparing Hanukkah to Christmas. You would have said, wow, you know, this is all one day. But the reality was that the rabbis of that generation, Matityahu and his family, whoever was around at that time, would, with the influence of the rabbinic fraternity, would come along and say, we've got to do something to recognize this. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to have next year, Lashana Acheret, we're going to have an 8-day holiday. And that's the way they fixed it. Hashmonaim and all the various leadership at the time.
We don't read about it.
That's not, I don't know if that's really true. That's just the interpretation.
But again, you have to look in. It's Hanukkah, as I said, works on so many levels, and it's almost as if we want to make ourselves naive to the whole historical level. We don't delve into this and really need to, like we do. We make ourselves naive with Purim, and we don't think about the historical context, which. Without that, you're really missing the whole point of the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And with Hanukkah, I really feel it's the same deal, the same problem. And therefore, you know, there is there are many historians, Gedalia Alon in Israel, who was a very famous historian, wrote about it. Victor Cherikow, who wrote in English, was, I think, at JTS, I'm not mistaken. I think so. He also, a book on the period. Saul Liebman, also in JTS, wrote about the Hellenization in Israel. You know, there have been major scholars writing about it, but because it's so scholarly, the average Jew in the street doesn't get to see this stuff, or doesn't even know it exists. And it is fascinating.
Too busy making the
life. And we become, that's, you know what, in a way, that's it. Because how do we get that message to a young generation that can't deal remotely with all the ramifications of what we've been saying? So we make it more down to earth. We turn it into food, we turn it into that type of celebration. Gedalia Alon, fabulous.
What's the name of the book?
Again, a number of books, but he's got a book on the history of the Greeks. It's also been translated into English, but the Hebrew is so much better.
History of Hanukkah. What is
it's about the whole thing of Hellenization, the period of
That's
the Maccabim. Gedalia Alon, yeah, in Hebrew. Which is also, there's a lot of reading. There's really a lot of reading to do here. The bottom line of what we've been saying here, right, is that. All with everything that we've studied today, and I think this hopefully has been a bit enlightening, to put it mildly, the reality of it is that Hanukkah is really a very special time. With all the question marks that we may have, we've kind of pushed all those questions to one corner. We've focused on the element which we can handle the best, and that has become the crutch, has become the support, taken us around the world. We've traveled literally, as I said here, a journey in the world of halakha, right? And the rabbis said it when they started the whole Gemara. They say, my Chanukah, what is Chanukah? And they answered, the Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis teach. The fact that it's become a holiday of learning and teaching and discussion and whatever else, that in itself has become the focus of the celebration, certainly in rabbinic terms. The historical part of it, I leave you to do some more reading, to more investigation, because that is the interesting part, but that's also the controversial part.
The bottom line is, without the halakha, then you have nothing to pass down.
Correct. Because then it just really does become something which fades away. It becomes a footnote in history. With the halakha, it becomes alive every year. I'll leave you at that. We're holding now for break. I think maybe we'll start up again either the end of January or the beginning of February. I'll send you a list of topics. Mir Tashem. And wish everybody a very happy and jolly Hanukkah, to put it mildly. And should really be a good break. Everybody should be... please God.